Paper 4, Section 4, which is old single column, page 58. Let's see. I think we'll just launch into this one. You'll see that it was a rather fortuitous break that we found last week, because there's gonna be a little bit more head scratching substance in this section that we'll want to step our way through. If you have an infinite eternal ellipse handy, you might want to break it out. But I'll hold up the chart. All right, let's get started here.
4. The realization of God. God is the only stationary, self-contained, and changeless being in the whole universe of universes, having no outside, no beyond, no past, and no future. God is purposive energy, creative spirit, and absolute will. And these are self-existent and universal.
Okay. Little tiny paragraphs here started out. But those who have been at this for a little while, as we've been expanding on deity, you should have noticed a couple things that caught your eye there. So they're wanting us to appreciate some of the fullness of the entirety of God the Father, not just the universal Father, part of God the Father, but the whole picture. And look at where they're starting. They're starting at the root of the Father. Okay, God is the only stationary. Okay, so this circuit of the Father, this second from the inside circuit here, with the universal Father in it. The root is there in the first functional level, as the first center. Right? Okay, that first functional level of total deity, that's the stasis of deity. Capital S, the functioning of capital D deity on that first level, that's the stasis of deity. Stasis of deity. God is the only stationary. Okay? Remember in the stasis of deity here, that's where the stationary aisle and things like that are. Okay, right? So that's about that first functional level. Self-contained. Okay, in that stasis of deity, he's the first center, which is the omnipersonal side of the universal one of infinity. That facet of deity, the universal one of infinity, is self-contained deity. That's that fundamental label on that facet of deity. You're just stepping through it. Stationary, self-contained, and changeless being. Okay, changeless, the Father is existential deity. Okay? So they're pointing you to the first functional level, the root of the Father there. And then they go on, having no outside, no beyond, no past, no future. Okay, no past, no future. Again, existential deity. Just reminding you of another consequence that it's existential deity. It's an eternal present for the Father. It's no past, no future. He goes all the way around the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay, and now having no outside, no beyond, no outside, no beyond. What does that remind you of? When we, that sort of the talk always comes up about what's on the outside and the inside when we're talking about God the Mother and the womb, of the Mother, about finite upholder, absolute upholder. Absolute upholder. Yeah, but the Father is the infinite upholder. The point where Mother meets Father, really, where It's sort of that the point where you sort of transcend any sort of direct meaning of the words father and mother anymore. That quote-unquote womb, which isn't really kind of literally a womb anymore, but that womb-like fact at the infinite level, okay, that has no outside, no beyond. It's at the infinite level. The personal presence of the Father has no bounds. You can't go outside of the presence of the Father as the infinite upholder. So just all those little things, they should be, as you read through those, that should catch your eye. It's like, okay, I know what that's referring to. Anchor yourself in the picture when you see key words like that. If nothing else, it should have just, it's like, wait a minute, self-contained, that's a very significant, and that got you into it. And then you start, oh yeah, and it's so stationary too, doesn't it? And all these other things you start noticing. Now, at the end there, and these are self-existent and universal. We all know that there's three of the facets that we use the adjective universal for. And so that's very reminding you of a lot of the Father, the universal Father, universal Creator, universal Controller. But self-existent, okay? Now, directly as an actuality, the facet of deity that is self-existent deity is the infinite. The Father, and you follow the Father down to the root, you find that as the first center, he's in direct relationship to the infinite. And if you recall back when they brought it up in the foreword, we contemplated that, imagining starting here at the lastly the infinite upholder, at that extremity of the Father, and following the Father back to the root. If you follow the Father all the way back, and so you're kind of, when you're thinking about that full circuit of the Father, back to the root, you use the expression the Father infinite. The Father all the way back into direct relationship with the infinite. It's in that sense, he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. If you start with just the I am, as a conceptual existence, and he's freeing himself from the fetters of that, in terms of the actualities of the facets of deity that are there when all is said and done, I mean, you're starting with basically that which just is, I am, and the Father is freeing himself from the fetters of that as just all by himself. You can see that he has very immediate relationship to what you're going to finally call self-existent deity. He's self-existent too. It's just that, that the mere, that basic essence of the I am that is left behind when everything is all pulled out of it. Just that residual core of just self-existence as self-existence. That is theoretically separate, but that boundary is transcendent of everything. So you follow it back and you basically have the Father infinite, if you want to think about the personalization of that deity that you're calling the Father infinite, what are you going to call it besides God the infinite? Anyway, so it's in that sense that they're reminding you of, he's the only being in the whole universe of universes that is actually here. As a transcendent personal fact, he's anchored in the stasis of deity domain. The Isle is not a person. The Trinity is not a person. The functioning of Trinity is not a, the infinite's not a person. But there's a person here. That first source and center is a person in the most transcendent way we can, hope to imagine. But nonetheless, it's there. He's the only being that's anchored there. I mean, the sun and spirit are over here. I mean, it's only one being that's anchored in the stasis of deity. See? You know, it has that direct relationship to self-existence and those issues. Now, the one other thing that's in there, just pointing out purpose of energy, creative spirit. Okay, now, when we start talking about energy, we have energy, just energy. Now, purposed energy, what do we call, what's the single word that the revelators use for purposed energy?
Pattern.
Yeah, if you impose pattern upon energy.
Personality?
No, it's personality, spirit pattern. Pattern or energy pattern is what you impose upon an energy actuality. You start with an energy
power.
Actuality. What?
Power,
exactly.
Purpose of energy.
Purposed energy is power. You know, the Father has a relationship to purposed energy. And so he's, you can think of him as purposive energy. That's the universal controller after, you know. Okay. But I just wanted to step aside a second. You don't think so much about the Father, but just think about what they're pointing out he has a relationship to. Purposed energy is power. And that parenthetical, when you think about spirit in relationship with purposed energy, with power, that kind of spirit, if you will, the flavor of spirit when it's in direct association or engagement of power is creative spirit. And, you know, and then, you know, when you take that all the way down to the local universe level and you talk about the mother and father at the local universe level, what's the part of the name of the mother at the local universe level? Creative spirit, okay? You know, it starts with creative spirit, becomes creative mother spirit. So you can think of her as being the direct, local personification of spirit that's engaging power, creative spirit. You know, she is the local creative spirit, capital C, capital S. See? Okay, so all of that is woven into that, just that tiny little set of words there.
What's creative power in relation to omnipotence?
So when you talk about power, if you're talking about power relative to the total finite, you use the expression almighty. If you're talking about power in a transcendent way, then you use omnipotent. So, it's just
the same thing.
Right. I mean, if I'm going to talk about the universal controller, that facet of the Father that's directly engaging the Isle and power, I would speak of the nature of that fact as being omnipotent, but it's in an infinitely transcendent sense of omnipotent. It's a lot more omnipotent than just that power aspect of God the ultimate, if you will, or God the absolute. It's really, 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 really omnipotent. Okay, but nonetheless, in just the sense of transcendence, when you use that omni prefix, Father's omnipotent. Yeah. But he's not just omnipotent, like they're reminding you, because what he's engaging is in association with spirit. So in order to fully engage that power, he has to also engage the spirit. So he has both aspects engaging it, and of course he engages it not really separately, and that's kind of why they've done it parenthetically there. At the same time that he's engaging power, he's engaging spirit, because he can't engage them separately. He engages them both together, which is a way of engaging it that even transcends the aisle and the sun. The sun can only engage the spirit. The aisle can only engage the energy. The Father can engage both simultaneously because he can't do anything else except engage, because he's antecedent to this differentiation of power and personality or energy and spirit.
The other thing that's nice about this, those two words, purposive and creative, they give that power a positive focus. Whereas Christians have known, and everybody's known the word omnipotent for a long time, but that's had, it's had positive creative aspects, but it's had a lot of negative aspects. And so this is definitely on, only on the positive side.
Right, that's part of why they're, they put the parenthetical in there, is to remind you that the two are never actually separate, especially if you're talking about the Father. To us, matter and spirit initially seem very, very separate, complete, and you know, at odds with one another, apparently, you know, and you know, almost like an antithesis. You know, and that's why humans have such a tendency to actually think in terms of the, that dichotomy. You know, if you favor your spiritual consciousness, you have a strong tendency to treat spirit as positive and matter as negative. You know, a thesis and antithesis, which of course is wholly false, but that's your initial sense, you know, and of course vice versa. Where you can think of matter as positive and you know, and spirit as negative. I mean, that's why positivists call themselves positivists. You know, positivism is a declaration that whole notion of spirit, you know, or anything that transcends matter is a negative notion, that it isn't literally a fact, you know, et cetera. See, so that's all in play. So just by putting those two together, they're challenging all those sorts of dichotomies and you know, tangents that humans have gone on. You have full purposive energy, but in intimate connection to creative spirit and vice versa. The two are not enemies, they're not at odds, they're one. All right, so they give you that little paragraph with a lot of detail that we just pulled all apart. And then they have a paragraph that kind of allows you to reflect on that a little bit. So let's see what they say in the next one here.
Since God is self-existent, he is absolutely independent. The very identity of God is inimical to change. I, the Lord, change not. God is immutable, but not until you achieve paradise status can you even begin to understand how God can pass from simplicity to complexity, from identity to variation, from quiescence to motion, from infinity to finitude, from the divine to the human, and from unity to duality and triunity. And God can thus modify the manifestations of his absoluteness because divine immutability does not imply immobility. God has will. He is will.
Okay, so you can see a lot of that is sort of just running with foundational facts that they brought out in the first paragraph, and then they just reminded you again on top of that that in one of the facets of the Father that's in that circuit of the Father is the first source, you know, basically the infinite one, the reservoir of all will. So you know, and it's not that he so much that he has will, he is will. Part of what the God the Father, you know, the Father is that reservoir of will. He is will. And any will that's not there is because he's willed it to be elsewhere. You know, he has individuated a measure of that total will and doled it out, bestowed it somewhere, you know, as a personality. Okay, so the point, you know, I think you can see is, I mean, you can read those two paragraphs and you know, there's a sort of a spirit of those two paragraphs that, you know, you'll come away with something. But there's a lot of very precise stuff in there, too. They're wanting you to, once you get to this point, to have the two, you know, the facts and the ideals in your mind simultaneously as you read that and come away with a really solid notion of God. Not something that's very fuzzy and tangible, but think, you know, something that you can chart and point at and think about the, you know, the differences and the relationships and something you can understand, not just believe and write poetry about. And understand it. You know, like they say, okay, now, you know, the technical, you know, notice how they word that. Not until you achieve paradise status can you even begin to understand how. Okay, the how part, yeah, I mean, none of us know how to write the equations, you know, about the absolute level or anything like this. I mean, that's completely beyond our comprehension. But logically, you know, philosophically, because of the revelation, you can begin to think about the, you know, the basic why and even if you can't understand how it all gets bestowed, you know, or distributed, they reveal the facts, you know, they reveal it's the distribution of deity, and then you can step back and appreciate the logic of that statement, even if you couldn't have derived that from first principles. You know, you can't understand how and derive it from first principles, obviously. But we can certainly take what the revelators tell us and step back and it's like, okay, yeah, that does make sense. That's logical. I see how that fits together. I never would have imagined that infinite eternal ellipse and the, you know, and the six facets of the Father. I never would have imagined all that, but it's been revealed to me. And once it's revealed, I have a reality response. I have the three cosmic intuitions, and I get a response to that. Yeah, that, you know, that looks factual. That looks causal, logical. I understand that. Yeah. In that basic sense. Yeah.
You mentioned poetry, and it's not poetry. And I agree with you getting there. It's not poetry, but once we make that adjustment of will, and we have these transformations of mind, then it's like we may see poetry in the prose of everyday life more and more.
I mean, there is powerful poetry in all of this rich complexity. You know, if you take up the challenge to wrap your mind around it enough that, you know, that you can feel it, you will be influenced by it. When it really kind of sinks in, this incredible, you're recognizing the infinite and the eternal. You can see some of it. You'll weep. It's poetic in your mind, because it has beauty, the way it all comes together. But you have to challenge yourself to go beyond those very first levels of beauty. You have to challenge yourself to get up to higher levels of beauty recognition in order to appreciate it. But it's there to be had. It's there to once you taste the beauty of a bigger domain of reality, you'll never be satisfied with that tiny little space that you used to satisfy yourself with anymore. You will have supplied the favorable conditions for growth. And the instant that the favorable conditions are there, she fills it. You know? It's just you, you know, expand outward and boom, the mother is there instantly. How much time is between the seventh adjutant engaging you and your encirclement in the Holy Spirit? Zero time. It's instantaneous. She doesn't wait 1 second to respond to your consecration to more capacity. You know, you pull out your boundaries and immediately more of the cosmos is there to be had. You know, and you can begin to get a shorter and shorter time constant in a feedback, you know, positive feedback loop set up. When you start to, you know, you allow some growth, you are grown, and that immediately leads to you allowing some more growth and being grown. And, okay, you're now following truth. You know, until that boundary is moving, you can't follow truth. Truth is only to be found in that dynamic environment of an expanding horizon within your consciousness. There is no truth in a static capacity. You know, there's just the fact there, you know. And then, but you have a notion of truth, and to satisfy you just falsely exalt this fact into truth. Now the truth is in the motion of the expansion of that mind. And so, I know, you know, this is a long-standing difficulty. When everyone who's found the book over these decades, you know, there's a lot of parts in the book. It's like, well, what's the point of all this? I mean, okay. The point is, you say you want to be a truth seeker. Do you know what that means? It means you must have an expanding horizon within your mind. That's what a truth seeker looks like. You can't be a truth seeker in a static domain. And all you'll do is become a self-exalted fact finder. You know, you'll find some facts and you will call them truth. And they may be really cool and you may be motivated to, it's like, I've got to call them something more than a fact. Because I see how they're better than that guy's facts. And so my facts are truth and his facts are falsehood. You know, that's the mode humans have always been in, you know. And, you know, that's putting new wine in old wineskins. But, you know, you don't want to just become another phenomenon like that, only, you know, all you've done is just kind of slightly rearrange the deck chairs here in the initial little space you had, and now you call it a Urantia space instead of a, you know, a Catholic space or something. You know, that's not all you want to do. You want to, you know, become this expanding phenomenon. All right.
God is the being of absolute self-determination. There are no limits to his universe reactions, save those which are self-imposed. And his free will acts are conditioned only by those divine qualities and perfect attributes which inherently characterize his eternal nature. Therefore is God related to the universe as the being of final goodness plus a free will of creative infinity.
Okay. There's a little fact that you want to have anchored here before you read the next paragraph, which sort of, it's like a little one paragraph essay on this paragraph again. So pull the chart out again. Did you notice a hyphenated word in there that we've seen before? Self-determination. Do you remember a while back when we came upon that paragraph up in the Supreme Papers, where it had this long list of self-hyphen words, and we noticed, oh, wait a minute, those are all the ways in which we have abilities because of a parallel to all those different self-ability facets of deity. Self-distributive, self-expansive, you know, all those various facets of deity. One of those was self-determination. And we recognized that self-determination, it's an ability that we have because of an association with a self-purposive deity, the infinite potential, self-purposive deity. Okay. God is a being of absolute self-determination. So, again, we're following the Father back towards his roots. We get to the second functional level here, where the infinite potential is, self-purposive deity. The Father's relationship to self-purposive deity will give him self-determination, just like it does us. Only, where is he when he's coming into direct relationship with that self-purposive deity? He's in this second functional level right next to the Absolute. God is a being of absolute self-determination. When he comes into relationship with self-purposes of deity, has self-determination, he's also in direct association with the Absolute. Okay, following the Father, like I said, following the Father all the way back to the root, we call that full spread of the Father infinite. If we just follow the Father back to this point, when we notice the relationship to the absolute, we call that the Father absolute. How does the next paragraph start out? Okay. The Father absolute and the Father infinite are two technical terms, you know, describing if you start where you are out here and you follow the Father back, if you get back to the relationship with the absolute, you call that much of those five facets, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the Father absolute. If you go back all the way, this get the sixth facet at the root, now you have the Father infinite. Father infinite. Okay? That's what that term means. So when you when you think about the Father infinite, you have, for instance, the reservoir of will in play. So that if you're going to make beings, you have to have a reservoir of will that you can dole out personality from. You know, that's the quiver that the Father reaches back into, pulls out an arrow of personality and bestows it. Okay? So with that in mind, see them. They actually were invoking it in a very technical way up there with that absolute self-determination statement, and then they pick that up. Now again, you can read those two things before without all that, and you'll get something. But see, there's this very, very deep total deity sort of invocation of specificity and technicality that's going on, you know, in the midst of these paragraphs too. You know, when you're talking about the realization of God, you know, the title of this section, we've noticed that one of the things that we have to right away start challenging ourselves is to not use realization and recognition as synonyms. You know, we often do that. It's like, I just realized. No. You know, think about it. You just recognized. Realize, that's a whole other step. You know, to take it from recognition up a notch to realization, to bring in having recognized, if you then use your personality to grasp it and incorporate it into your being, now you've realized it. Okay? And so we're talking about the realization of God. We're talking about he has all of these facets, you know, that are all being grasped by a personality and realized. See, so that's why in this section called realization, they're for the more advanced student, they're giving you pointers to all the facets. So you start to think about, you know, the full six facets of the Father that are all together realized, you know, personalized as God the Father. Okay? And there's all kinds of ways to appreciate that complexity, simplicity to complexity. We're, you know, like they said in that previous paragraph, you know, we're trying to take our notion of God from simplicity to complexity so that it's truer and it's more fertile for understanding other things. It's a big step forward to actually have the notion of the universal Father as a concept, you know, that there's a fathering of reality. But we're trying to, that was the fourth epical revelation. Jesus revealed that 2,000 years ago. Now they're trying to take it to the next notch to get the full spectrum of God the Father. All right, so there you have it. Absolute self-determination, that in the absolute, simultaneously in relationship to the absolute, he has a relationship to the infinite potential, self-purposive deity. That's where his self-determination is rooted. It's absolute self-determination. Okay. All right. So with that absolute self-determination of the Father in mind, you have the following statement.
The Father absolute is the creator of the central and perfect universe and the Father of all other creators. Personality, goodness, and numerous other characteristics God shares with man and other beings, but infinity of will is his alone. God is limited in his creative acts only by the sentiments of his eternal nature and by the dictates of his infinite wisdom. God personally chooses only that which is infinitely perfect, hence the supernal perfection of the central universe. And while the Creator's sons fully share his divinity, even phases of his absoluteness, they are not altogether limited by that finality of wisdom which directs the Father's infinity of will. Hence, in the Michael order of sonship, creative free will becomes even more active, wholly divine and well-nigh ultimate, if not absolute. The Father is infinite and eternal, but to deny the possibility of his volitional self-limitation amounts to a denial of this very concept of his volitional absoluteness.
Okay. Just, if you step back and reflect on that, they're just giving you a little bit of appreciation of the limitations of having a root in the stasis of deity. You know, for him to be the, you know, it sounds like, wow, that'd be really cool. I wish I had my roots of being in this, you know, in the infinity of the stasis of deity. Well, but there's that limits you in some pretty severe ways. You can't have anything except infinity of will then. And to think about that logically, like they're trying to point out, it means you're just stuck there. Notice that, when they say creative free will becomes even more active, in contrast to the stasis of deity, see where we started this description. If I imagine a creator son acting, he's not spread into every nook and cranny of infinity. You know, he's a finite being. But he comes from that source, and he can reach back to that. So he can express just infinity of will, just because he's a finite being. But he can challenge himself upward to absonity of will and even absoluteness of will, like they're pointing out there. But see how, I mean, there's an active thing there. You can expand. You can be an active phenomenon where you're expanding upward into higher and higher levels. Father can't do that. This is the top. There's nowhere to expand to. Okay? See, so there's a stuckness to that. That they're so and he has submitted himself to that stasis for your benefit, so that you are not so limited. Matter of fact, so that you can be. If he hadn't pulled himself back to the boundary there of infinity, there would be no place for you to be. And there certainly would be no place for you to grow, be an active, expanding phenomenon. If you've just hypothetically imagined you were somehow there, it's like, I want to grow, but try. You're pushing against an infinite wall. How successful do you think you're going to be? There's no room for you to grow. He has to pull himself back so that there's space for you to grow. So that he's not infinitely pushing you down to the zero point. See, that's, you know, an infinite, you know, inward force means there's no, you can't be. Crushes you, you know, to zero. So that they're just pointing out. So, you know, that by him submitting to the stasis of deity, it gives you the opportunity of growth to eternity. You can grow all the way to that point of co-absoluteness. You can follow from the bottom up the path that the Creator Son followed from the top down. And see, the thing about that, and you think, well, if he starts at the top, doesn't he bring the absoluteness all the way down? Well, we all know that the Creator Son is not given sovereignty over his local universe until he gets all the way down. And the basic logical reason there is, if you're going to understand individuality, individuality has to be in relationship to an absolute. And it, you know, a finite individual is relative. Well, relative to what? Relative to an absolute. I mean, to be relative, there has to be an absolute as well. I mean, that's why the revelation starts us all out with, well, you recognize you're this little finite relative thing. In order for you to recognize the logical universe you exist in, we need to reveal the seven absolutes of infinity, the seven relativities of your relativeness, so that your individuality viewpoint is logical. In order for the sun, the creator sun, to have full how do I want to say this? You have this relativity and absoluteness. This the relative and the absolute. In order for the creator sun to have full access to his potential absoluteness, he has to have fully embodied the relativity. The two go hand in hand. If you can just think about the logic of that.
That's his favorable condition.
Right. He achieves the full favorable conditions for access to absoluteness by penetrating all the way down. And only when he gets all the way down to the bottom and incorporates that into his being, realizes that, does the absoluteness come into play? And see, how do they word that? If not absolute, it's well nigh ultimate, if not absolute. They recognize that there's a potential expression there as a master son that can fully transcend now. You're doing it the other way. You're building up, and you don't have access to that, measure of absoluteness, if you will, a co-absoluteness, until you fill it all the way up from the bottom up. You have full relativity, and so then you have full access to absoluteness, and vice versa. The two go hand in hand. It's just they're a logical couple. Okay. You got a thought you want to throw in there? Or?
He brings to bear new levels of infinity onto the situation, but maybe he doesn't do that. He just did it at the beginning, and that's it. And now, until we fill it in through successive levels of the supreme, ultimate, and God the absolute.
Well, remember you're talking about your experience bottom up. I mean, it's all already there.
Right.
Yeah. You're just not aware it's all there because you're moving up in awareness in the picture.
Yeah.
It's actually all there.
Yeah.
It was filled in from the top down. The main way is coming up in the first sentence of the next paragraph. I mean, we know that even though he's sort of confined himself up there, pulled out of infinity, in other words, pulled himself to the boundary so that, there could be other, that those absolute points that are in direct association with all that relativity that he's now allowed for, he's behind all those absolute points. Mm-hmm. And so that's the next thing they come to here.
God's absoluteness pervades all seven levels of universe reality. And the whole of this absolute nature is subject to the relationship of the Creator to his universe creature family. Precision may characterize Trinitarian justice in the universe of universes, but in all his vast family relationship with the creatures of time, the God of universes is governed by divine sentiments. First and last, eternally, the infinite God is a father. Of all the possible titles by which he might appropriately be known, I have been instructed to portray the God of creation, of all creation, as the universal father.
Okay. So, obviously that is, when all is said and done, the father idea is still the highest concept of God, a human concept of God. The last sentence in the book is being pointed to there. and you know, when we often talk about the absoluteness of the Father is the initiator. But notice they're worried a little bit about the point that James brought up. You know, that we might lose personality in the midst of all this. You know, you spend all this time contemplating all these technical facets of deity and all this stuff, and they're trying to say, no, remember, none of that greater complexity dilutes one iota the person, you know, the fact that the Father is an infinite personality. This is all personal. Okay? And in that sense of, you know, the word Father being a personal word, they italicize that. And then also, you know, the divine sentiment. Did you notice that he used sentiment in the previous paragraph too?
I did too.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So, and notice the contrast up there. God is limited in his creative acts only by the sentiments of his eternal nature and by the dictates of his infinite wisdom. Sentiments, you know, mean basically sense, feeling. Okay. What the divine sentiment, he has a divine internal sense, insight. So within his nature is an infinite insight, a perfect infinite insight. There's that, and that's where fundamentally that person is rooted, just like we are. We get the seventh adjunct engages, we're encircled in the Holy Spirit. We now actually have insight. We have an inner sense. And in the context of that, personality can begin to manifest. So they're pointing out the Father's the same way. So there's that sentiment of his eternal nature that just in and of itself has this nature, but he also has a relationship to all the external, and that relationship brings in an infinite wisdom that also, see, as an input, dictates. See, God is limited by the dictates of his infinite wisdom. You know, that which is external coming in through the wisdom. You know, the wisdom is connected to the facts. External facts, bringing that into the inner domain where there's this divine sentiment and a person is rooted. You know, so he's got the whole picture. All the outside, you know, the biggest outside that any being can have, you know, the relationship to the most outside that any being can have, the biggest inside that any being can have, and all of that is perfectly personal. You know, there's no part of that that is not personal. You know, there's no completely indifferent, omnipotent thing. You know, yeah, there's omnipotence, but not with the slightest measure of disconnect from the fact that he's a Father and loves you, okay, with an infinite, absolute love.
Our task to do is to take the complexity you get. I mean, you've given us lots of complexity.
Yeah.
With
I believe actually the relators gave it to us. I just kind of pointed it out.
But, you know, and it can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
I mean, your task is to say, okay, who is God in this concept? And maybe a little bit on the skin of that. And then you simplify that in your consciousness.
Right, and then move it out. Just focus on that one little key thing that you're bringing in. Because, see, that's what they're reminding of us about in this paragraph, emphasizing, you know, italicizing Father, and using the family, you know, that there's the notion of a universe creature family, invoking that family picture. All of the complex, like you were just saying, all that complexity of the Father is brought into one focus, because that's what personality is. It's a focusing mechanism. Okay? And they're reminding you, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to be godlike. You're going to do the same thing. You're going to open yourself up to more of the picture, but you're going to bring it all to a focus still with your personality. You're going to actually use more of your personality. See, there's a limit. Personality can only do so much in a fixed space. It's like, okay, I focused that. Okay, now what? Well, no, I think I'm just going to stay there forever. Well, I mean, you know, the moment you stop, you're dead, remember? You know, personality is meant to be this ever ongoing focusing, refocusing, 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 because you're expanding. Every time you expand, the whole picture changes and you have to refocus it. You need to be using your personality. If there's no need to refocus because nothing is expanded, you know, the personality, you know, is just twiddling its thumbs, and so is the adjuster. I mean, there's nothing to do. The Father, you know, has no relationship to that static thing. See, and that's the irony. One of the ironies that they're bringing in. It's the Father is in some sense stuck, you know, in that stasis of deity. But he has full access to all that he's delegated, so that he can participate in what we experience, what I was just describing. Okay.
The other word for focusing is harmonizing.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, that you're. I mean, you know, in terms of
just throwing it together and moving on.
But just, you know, I mean. Right, I mean, to think about it, it's not just crushing it together, you know, not that kind of a focusing. You know, it can only be brought to a focus if it's properly coordinated. Only a harmony can be focused. Cacophony can't be focused.
There's been a lot of talk on a planet such as this. I think we have a particular problem with the word Father, because of the connotation of maleness. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. I don't think there's any stronger advocate than the recognition of God the Mother. You all know that. You know, and part of that importance of that full advocacy, that full recognition of God the Mother, is so that you can better appreciate God the Father. If you don't have the fullness of God the Mother to satiate all of your, you know, inner sense that there must be Mother, if you somehow limit the notion of Mother in your mind, you corrupt the notion of Father in your mind. You know, they're trying to give you, they're speaking, you know, they're about to, you know, give you a little bit more just along that line too, so I don't want to jump ahead. But they're starting up this fuller recognition of the Father that there has to be this initiator. And the most appropriate word, like I said, of all the possible titles by which he might appropriately be known, I have been instructed to portray the God of all creation as the universal Father. Because there, you have to recognize that there's this separation. You have the whole initial notion of God the infinite, but there's no one else. In order for there to be space for something besides just the one being, God the infinite, there has to be a separation that occurs. Part of God the infinite becomes God the transcendent. God as transcendence, that part of personalized deity, or that part of deity that can be personalized there, that can pull itself out, does. God as transcendence. And that allows another part of that deity to be expressed in distinction to that which has pulled itself out, the God that remains within, God as immanence, God the Mother. You know, there's no, you know, this is on the same plane. You know, the moment that you actually create God the Father, conceptually in your mind, you create God the Mother. The upholder within. And so, I mean, there, you know, that is a womb. That is God the Mother. God within and intimate to you and upholding you. Father. I mean, we all understand. You know, mother is not that controversial. It's the father, like you're saying, it's the father thing that's controversial. You need to understand the role of father in relationship to this family of creatures that are being held by the mother.
Can I just interject something here?
Yeah.
I think we're handicapped on this, and maybe beings on every planet are, until we come up with a much higher definition of father and mother. That's not male and female.
Yeah. I think it's the next paragraph.
So limited.
Right. It's the next paragraph.
Aren't I good?
Okay. But is where they directly challenge that. But I just, you know, but it's fine to stop here and motivate the next paragraph a little bit. To understand more in a higher sense, in a truer sense, what the father fact is in the family. In differential to the mother fact. You know, in the totality of reality, there's a father fact and a mother fact, and children. Okay? The mother fact is right there, so intimate, so close to you, that she's practically unrecognizable. Those who reveal to us over the millennia didn't even try to reveal God the Mother until the fifth epical revelation, because humans have to reach a level of subtlety of recognition and distinction that only we are only now beginning to have, where you can differentiate what is completely enveloping you from you. I mean, it's we take the mother for granted. She's so intimate, so, you know, that she's invisible, basically. That's the mother fact. The father fact is not such an invisible fact, not something that is easily taken for granted, because the father fact is poke, 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 poke. I mean, the father fact is on the outside poking in. I mean, why do you need a father fact? If all you had was a mother fact, you'd just lay there in eternal bliss of being held. Okay? But that's not what it's all about. You need to do something as well as be something. Poke, 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 poke. Okay? That's the father. You know, you're getting too complacent. Poke, 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 poke. That's okay, the different, you know, that's what a father does. And I've tried to point, I mean, think about how the life carriers designed us as males and females to do this truer sense of mother and father instinctually. Everyone knows the mother instinct and maternal instinct does that whole, you know, you're so intimate, the child just basically takes the mother for granted. But the father, as soon as the mother feels the child is ready for the poke, 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 the father influence, she hands the child to the father, and without even thinking about it, the father goes, whee! Throws the child up in the air and gives the child the first experience of separation. Pokes, you know? It's like, okay, you're really complacent. I need to shake you up a little bit, you know? What are you going to do with separation? You know, you have to come to terms with it. And the mother, you know, the mother's not going to give you separation. The mother holds you as tightly as possible, so there's no gap. Yay! the father immediately wants to create, you know, a differential. So I mean, that they're just pointing out that is true all the way up to the highest levels. There is that which is other. That's outside. Poking that which is in, prodding it forward to move, to do something as well as be something. But most fundamentally, I mean, when you see the word Father in the book, it's in this highest sense of mother is womb. Father is not. If something is called Father in the book, like God the Father, okay, that's an injection into womb. There's womb, and then there's that which outside the womb and pokes its finger into womb. You know, the first, you know, it first pokes in it and individuates you. It makes those individuals. Bing, 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 bing. You remember, the father is the individuality of the parts. The mother is the individuality of the whole. There's a whole with children in that whole. And there's an individuality of that whole. There's a mother. But where did the parts come from? It came from the individuality of the parts. Part, 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 part. You know, every time he touches, there's a new part. You know, there's a, you know, he bestows a little measure of individuality of partness. Okay? Here, 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 here. Okay? You know, and then those parts are connected to each other through the individuality of the whole. Not through the initiator. This distinction is vital. Yeah, like we said at the beginning. Okay. That's how the, and so just appreciating these basic, the relationship between the father influence and the mother influence, how they work together, how you can't have one without the other. There's no point to one without the other. I mean, they're just inseparable. They're a couple. Okay? And then challenge yourself to recognize the highest, truest meanings of the words mother and father, and then figure out how a male and a female, human, are downstepped expressions of that.
Yeah. I don't think that we're male or female. I think we're all male and female. We all come from a mother and a father. Mm-hmm. We all have either one body or the other, but I see evidence in everybody I know of male and female.
Okay, and where does that truth come from? How does that work? Let's just take another second to tease that out. We now have a revelation that allows us to directly understand that basic recognition or that thought. Okay, when they're talking about your relationship to the Father, be you female or male, what do they call you? An ascending son. Why? Because the personality that the father gave to Chris and the personality that the father gave to Sydney is not sex differentiated. There is no such thing as male and female personalities. There's just one flavor of personality. Okay? Now there's creator and creature personality. But, you know, setting a creator personality aside for a second, when you're talking about creature personality, there isn't male and female creature personality. There's just personality. Just like the adjuster. Remember how they tell you the adjuster was picking, you know, when the two adjusters picked those two people right there, they gave not the slightest consideration to the femaleness of Sydney or the maleness of Chris. The adjusters choose it independent of sex. Those, just that's the personality from the father is the same way. Those two things that are coming to the father are completely blind to the notion of male and female in a sex sense. Okay? So, but that is female and that is male. So if the father doesn't give rise to that, who does?
Mother.
The mother. Remember, you're a child of the cosmic mother. You're a son of the spiritual father. And that's why, so think about how there's another way to understand why there's two consecrations, why there's fundamentally two consecrations if you're going to holistically, wholeheartedly consecrate yourself. First, you have to consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father. You do that sex-independent consecration. But I'm not sex-independent. I'm male. How do I consecrate that fact? I have to consecrate my mind, my male self, to the universal harmony of God the Mother. Okay. That's why they call you a child, you know, male or female, child of the mother, but you're a son of the father. That's a sex independent relationship. See? So it's another way. It's like, think about how hard is it going to be if all you have in your theology, you know, your God notion, is God the Father. How difficult is it going to be to create some sort of a stable notion of what it means to be a male or what it means to be a female? I can't get that from my relationship to the Father. If I'm going to understand that, if I'm not going to be all wrapped around the axle about my maleness, and you're not going to be all wrapped around the axle about your femaleness, and you know, me being wrapped around the axle about your femaleness, and, you know, I mean, if this isn't just going to be a mess like it is right now in the world, you need the concept of the mother. You have to understand where that comes from. Okay? So there's just... See, the more you think about this, the more you understand why, now that humans are ready to have a bigger logical picture of things, you have to reveal God the Mother, the first epical revelation of God the Mother. And the fifth, you know, and full enough, clear enough, literally in black and white, hard to mess up, revelation of God the Father. Okay? The two, and we're ready to have both of them here, and we need them to understand who we are. I mean, how are we going to have social equity and the recognition of the difference between males and females, you know, and a harmonious system that recognizes those facts and integrates those facts into a harmony, if we have just no way to be comfortable in our own skin as a male or a female, if we're just fraught with, you know, angst and confusion about, well, what does it mean to be a male, you know, and why is it every time I try to be a male I just get this, you know, a really negative thing from that other thing called a female, and vice versa, and it's, you know, how do we fix this problem, you know? This distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system that male and that female are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. Only the mother can help you understand who you are and how you can connect across that boundary, because she's behind that difference, not the Father. The Father made you identical as transcendent persons.
Not communicate, connect.
Chris, I don't feel comfortable with saying that I have a female side, but I could feel comfortable with a mother.
Right, you have a relationship. See, that's what I was trying to get at. See, clarify the language a little bit so it isn't so mystical and kind of fuzzy. You have a relationship to the mother and a relationship to the father. Fundamentally, that, you know, what people have tried to express as your femaleness, that's your relationship to God the Mother. But it doesn't make you somehow, you know, if you're actually, you know, have this thing called testosterone and, you know, and this sort of stuff, you know, it doesn't make you, you know, somehow a fuzzball. It's because you have a relationship to God the Mother. You can still be a man and have a relationship to God the Mother.
Somewhere in here it says that throughout eternity, our initial identification with one sex or another, that stamp is on us.
Your experiential self,
yeah,
that which is related to experiential deity, the Mother, you know, that has a continuity to it. You have an ongoing selfhood. You have an ongoing relationship to God the Mother. But you also have an ongoing personality, a relationship, ongoing relationship to God the Father, and the two are identified with each other. Remember, personality identifies with that ongoing selfhood. It gives you an identity. You know, to say you have an identity is to say that your ongoing selfhood has been engaged by that which is outside and engages that which is within, you know, has been engaged by personality. Now you're not just a self, you're an identity. You're a personal self.
The mind that we have is, we separate in our physiology and as male and female. It comes from the universal mother spirit.
Right.
So, contemplate that a little bit, and it might help.
Yeah, yeah, right, again, yeah, she's the source of the mind. She's the source of the mind, exactly. Yeah.
Just super quick, I'm pretty good at all this stuff.
Yeah, I know you are.
Now, a mind isn't male or female, right? A mind is a mind is a mind?
No, mind is male. You have a mindful self. Okay. You have a body, right. Okay, which does has a male female differential. But the important distinction, you have that difference of body because there's a difference of mind, and so there has to be a difference of body because that mind is seated on that body. Okay. I mean, that's kind of, you have a difference of body because there's a difference of mind. Okay. Your consciousness is not in your matter. It's in your mind. It's a literal energy system seated on that matter. And that mind has a male or a female character. And at the most rudimentary level, the thing that really distinguishes it is on the female side. Female has maternal instinct. I mean, both of us are using the same facets of mind, the same seven adjutants of mind. But right off the bat, on that first adjutant, the thing that gets this differential in the mind between male and female started is that the thing that's called female uses a part of the first adjutant, that energy of instinct, that spirit of intuition, in a way that that which is called male doesn't. It expresses this thing called maternal instinct with that energy of instinct. And so right at that foundational level of mind, there's this differential established. You know, and the fact that it's not just maternal instinct, you know, and it's not just the energy of instinct, you know, we can call that first adjutant the spirit of intuition. And the word intuition, we know we also use that for the cosmic intuition, something that's connected to the highest. Okay, the hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. See, in other words, a female is designed by the life carriers to have a measure of the actual spirit of intuition, not just the energy of instinct, going in that first adjutant in a way that a male doesn't. A male is going to have to challenge himself fully with that first adjutant to make it the spirit of something instead of just the energy of something. He's going to have to choose. But there's a part that's automatic, if you will, you know, that's built in, designed in to the female, because you have to have some measure of this connection to destiny in order for this system to possibly be stable. If neither one of these, if we're going to make a differential and neither one had this connection to the cosmos programmed in, we would have ceased to exist a long time ago. Who would have upheld the children that were born? No one. They would have all died. Now, mankind would have lasted one generation. There has to be an upholder. There has to be a hand that rocks a cradle. And that is by design connected to destiny, that it's actual spirit of intuition to start with. Good. Yep.
So, males and females, is it cut and dyed? Is it gray?
Okay, well, you know, we all know that, you know, this thing gets really complicated because it's all, yeah. But let's not, you know, I mean, you know the complexity of this. I mean, you know that it's very precisely and clearly distinguished in material sons and daughters. This differential I'm talking about. But we're a downstep expression of that, where it's blurred together a little bit, because it has to be, because there's it's a difficult life on a nativity sphere. And many times one parent or the other is killed or dies. And the other, you know, the other parent has to have some measure to pick up a little bit of the slack of the other. Think about, you know, if the female dies, see, immediately that male has to try to challenge his first adjutant to be something besides the energy of instinct. He has to immediately establish some spirit of intuition there, so he has something that's maternal instinct-like in order to uphold that child the way the mother just did it by programming, okay, basically. But, of course, the flip side of that, how dark is it if a female overrides the programming, you know, and doesn't express maternal instinct? See, how, I mean, how cataclysmic is that to the whole family here, that, you know, this whole creature family notion that we establish. I mean, if there's no upholder at the bottom, then the whole thing collapses. And that's why it's such, you know, when you see a civilization where more and more females are so focused on self that they literally are overriding the spirit of intuition, the maternal instinct, that's the fall of Rome in beginning. I mean, that's civilization, you know, collapsing. That's a litmus test for when things are not looking well, when you start to see that happening. Okay, let's see. I think you were here first. Okay.
I thought this observation makes sense about intuition, because I was thinking about how animals have such a strong, maternal animals mm-hmm. have this instinct of nurturing their young.
Mm-hmm.
And since intuition is supposed to be the most basic of the seven, it makes sense to me what you're saying, that this is a part that's built into the intuition.
And reminds you of how, you know, when you get to mammals that are expressing that maternal instinct, how easy is it to anthropomorphize those animals? The root of that tendency really is there in that, in recognizing that. See, you're actually seeing, think about what I just said about this. You know, that animal doesn't have a separate personality. But if you're seeing maternal instinct, you're seeing a little measure of the personality of the creative mother spirit being expressed there. Hydrocarbons don't do that. Only a person is going to do that. Okay, and if that lion isn't literally a person, there has to be a very overt expression of some personality behind the scenes being manifested there. Who is that personality? That's the local universe mother spirit, the creative mother spirit, the local mother. That's the personality of the mother manifest in the world around us. So it's a way you can actually recognize her existence in a more direct way. If you logically think about how are those hydrocarbons doing that, where would a maternal instinct and a lion come from? I mean, yeah. Okay. So, was there? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, here. Yeah.
When I was in nutrition school, we read a book called Bested Nation. And I actually had an epiphany about researching the trend of families and how all the fast food restaurants popped up and then all the processed foods and how it started affecting health. And it wasn't a popular stance, but I blamed it on women's lib. And to me, I think that kind of brought home the fall of Rome, so to speak, in our nation.
Little homework assignment. You know, go to the marriage and family papers, find that paragraph that's speaking only to you, not to males. It's a paragraph that's speaking only to the females in the room. It's like, now having achieved this measure of liberation, are you going to drop the ball? You know, the hand that rocks the cradle still needs, there still needs to be a hand that rocks the cradle that fraternizes with destiny. If you drop that, okay, if you pervert that, if you put self first instead of, you know, being the initial upholder of the children of God, you know, the whole thing is going to collapse. Civilization is a choice, and it all starts with that choice. You know, now that you aren't sort of just, you know, you have no choice but to just, you know, do that, you have the liberty to do something else. You know, are you going to drop all your, you know, you women have a responsibility in the cosmic system, and males have another responsibility. They're not the same. We can't treat ourselves as interchangeable parts. The creative mother spirit can't pretend she's the creator son, and the creator son can't, you know, they know they're different, and they know why they're different. And the second they drop the ball and what their job is, the local universe collapses. You know,
The revelators knew what was coming then, because these papers were written about 40 years before the women's liberation movement really got.
See, I wonder if they have any ability to, you know, any foresight, any ability to kind of see the trends. You know. All
right. Okay.
The flip side of that is that men pulled back, men stopped being supportive, and too many women were left
trying to do everything. Raise children.
We all know why we're wrapped around the axle.
Yeah.
The point is, are we just going to spend the rest of eternity talking about, well, you know, he said, she said. I mean, you know, we have to, it's like, no, we're different. And we know how confused and messed up we've gotten about this.
The point I'm making here is that you can't just say,
let's move on.
We have this big responsibility.
I didn't say that. The author of that paper said it. Just go up and read what the author of that paper said and figure out what it means. It's not Chris. Why did that author say what they said? Why did they say, now, all you men, this paragraph's not for you. This is, I'm speaking directly to the women in the room, and I'm saying X. You know, go read what it says. You know, and it's not for me to tell you what you're supposed to do in response to that paragraph. It's a paragraph for you. You figure out what your response as an enlightened woman in a modern society is to that paragraph. You know, I doubt if what the revelator wants you to think is, oh, so I should just go back to the 10th century. The revelator's not pointing us back in time. The revelator is probably pointing us forward, telling us you need to take up the challenge. You've got effort. There's a lot of effort and struggle that went into the liberation of women in society. But now we're experiencing a conflict. You can go back to where there isn't that conflict, where you're just chattel, or you can go forward through faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. That's the challenge. And as we're saying, the challenge is now in front of you. You've never been liberated to the point where you could come into conflict with this line of truth. You're now coming into, because you've been liberated, you have a conflict that you have to deal with. You can't ignore it. You have to confront it. That's what liberty gives. Liberty opens you up to more conflicts in the cosmos. Lucifer opened up too many conflicts ahead of their time. I mean, all of those conflicts have to be dealt with, but not all at once in a bunch of primitive humans, okay? But in the fullness of time, women have been liberated, and now the challenge is in front of them, a challenge that was never there before. They have to assume a new measure of personal responsibility and self-control, a new recognition in the cosmos that they never had to before. You know, be careful what you ask for. I want to be liberated. Well, guess what? With every measure of liberty in the cosmos, there's another measure of personal responsibility that you have to assume. And you got to figure out how to balance all that.
And then it's the man's place to make an adjustment to that.
To harmonize with that. See, have you noticed that every time over the last many, many years that we bring up male and female, it basically eats up a whole hour of time? Because everyone's all wrapped around the axle? See, the extent to which you think you're not wrapped around the axle about this is invalidated, by the fruits. Yeah, we are wrapped around the axle. Everyone in this room is wrapped around the axle, and we have to all recognize this, Well, I mean, Katie just was, indirectly pointing to me too. Okay, but there's always a measure of being wrapped around the axle. You may not be wrapped around the axle in a primitive sense.
To greater and lesser degrees.
But
everybody's the same.
I mean, but there's we do not have light and life on this planet. There's a reason why. Because we're still wrapped around the axle to some degree. In order for there to be light and life, you have a whole bunch of growth that has to occur that hasn't occurred yet. Hasn't occurred in me. Hasn't occurred in anyone in this room. And the extent to which you don't think you need to grow anymore, well,
that's the degree to which you need to grow.
That's myself is innately divine. I've just turned it around. Okay.
Chris, can I say something?
No, that's just not there. Too many say somethings. We got to keep going here.
In God the Father, free will performances are not ruled by power, nor are they guided by intellect alone. The divine personality is defined as consisting in spirit and manifesting himself to the universe as love. Therefore, in all his personal relations with the creature personalities of the universes, the first source and center is always and consistently a loving father. God is a father in the highest sense of the term. He is eternally motivated by the perfect idealism of divine love, and that tender nature finds its strongest expression and greatest satisfaction in loving and being loved.
Okay. So there, I mean, so, you know, you don't have an extensive essay on what it means to be in the highest sense of the term. But the, you know, that's the challenge. The moment that you think you have a sense of the term, challenge yourself to have a higher sense of the term. You know, like I said, keep that moving. Keep the sense of that term moving in your mind, ever expanding. Okay, and now notice, poke, 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 poke. Notice the father thing here that they're bringing out. It finds its strongest expression and greatest satisfaction in loving and being loved. Pokes you so that you can, so to start up a dynamic relationship here. You know, until he pokes, you know, there's no, until there's an action, there's no possibility for a reaction. There's no possibility for a circuit, a personality circuit. You know? And he's trying to get you going in an eternal dynamic motion here in relationship to him. Poke, poke, poke.
Called a loving partnership.
Yeah. See, he's not just loving, but being loved. A circuit has two legs, loving, being loved. I want to be connected to the Father's personality circuit. Well, you know he's done this part. Have you done this part? Have you supplied the favorable conditions for you to be encircuited? No? It's like, well, I have feelings that I call love. Doesn't that encircuit me in the Father? No. Where's love? It's on the sixth level of meaning. Okay? In order to be participating in the Father's personality circuit, in order to do the other half of the circuit there, you have to get yourself up to the level of love. If you're just down there on the level of feeling with that word love, that's not in the Father's personality circuit. Love of flesh? No. Love of feelings? No. Love of mind? No. Logical level? No. Moral level? No. Spiritual level? Yes. You have to get all the way up there. You know, you have to get up to recognition. But it's sad to record that so few persons on the planet, you know, have any sort of choice, you know, active engagement of recognition. Besides their initial just crude encircuitment in recognition. Recognition, realization, appreciation, love. Clear up there. So how far is the Father's circuit from universal manifestation on the world? Well, it's sad to record that so few persons on the planet are up there with any measure by choice in the sixth level of meaning. So there's no personality circuit. There's just the selves that are being upheld. Okay? You have the mother upholding those selves, but the father part can't engage yet. You know, that's some of the facts that are woven into that. You know, that thinking about the details here. But again, it's just... It's just so important to allow the revelators to take away what you think the word Father means and then begin to rebuild that in your mind. Let it reform you. And some of these reformations are hard to do in an evolutional sense. Some of the things that we're starting with are just so crude that you just remember, we don't, you know, it's always, you know, in rebellion to have, you know, a revolution out here. But you, some things you need a revolution within. You need to just take that just hopeless clot of crap and just throw it out, okay? And let that space just be empty for a moment and then begin to fill it anew. Some things you can mold in place. Others are just so messed up. You know, do a revolution within. It's like, from this point on, that's it. I'm done with that. I'm just never going to try to do anything with that hopeless clot of junk anymore. I'm going to start from scratch here. It's a pretty, you know, the fact that mother, father, male and female is so difficult shows you there's an awful lot of that. It needs to be rebuilt from scratch. You need to just tear it all the way down to the ground floor and start over again. Don't try to add on an addition to that house, okay? Just, you know, get the dozer and flatten that little plot of land and start again.
Yeah. Yep. Chris, Jesus showed us what a loving father is.
Right. And, over and over, the divine counselor, you know, repeats this. Like, well, okay, so I'm starting to get that you're really trying to challenge me here. It'd be so wonderful if I had an example. Why is part four in the book? So you have a very direct example of what this looks like, and you can, what does an actual child of God look like when they're functioning visibly, to be recorded by midwayers and revealed to us in the fourth part? You can go and look up. That's what it looks like. All right, a little bit more here. Let's get this wrapped up.
In science, God is the first cause. In religion, the universal and loving Father. In philosophy, the one being who exists by himself, not dependent on any other being for existence, but beneficently conferring reality of existence on all things and upon all other beings. But it requires revelation to show that the first cause of science and the self-existent unity of philosophy are the God of religion, full of mercy and goodness, and pledged to effect the eternal survival of his children on earth.
Just notice that extended thing in philosophy, and it's not a pithy little thing. We've got this long thing there. Okay. The one being who exists by himself, not dependent on any other being for existence. Like, okay. No, he freed himself from fetters, unqualified affinity, that one self-existent being, you know, rooted in the stasis of deity, but beneficently conferring reality of existence on all things and upon all other beings. The initiator, the individuality of the parts, all those parts, all things and all other beings, all those parts. He's the individuality of those parts. That's the beneficence that they're talking about. He initiates you as a part, an actual and a real part. Okay. When I talk about the individuality of the parts, am I invoking the God of religion or the God of science? No, God of philosophy. See, that's something that only comes up, you know, no one has ever used that term before in human history. Why am I using that term now? Because I've recognized the philosophical uplifter character of this revelation. You know, this is here to uplift our philosophy. And so I now recognize all of that complicated thing, you know, in philosophy. And I can combine that with a God-centered science where I actually have a first cause and I have absolutes rather than the mess that, you know, we have now in the wake of the 20th century. And I can reinvigorate the true God of, you know, that's been there in religion for a very long time, because God the Father was revealed and has been trickling down through revelatory religion for a long time, I can put all three of those together. But the only way I could really get that philosophy part, you know, is through the revelations. Because that's a pretty complicated little thing that they just, you know, took a lot of words to even say it. See? Okay, that's why this book is big. Okay. All right.
We crave the concept of the infinite, but we worship and the experience idea of God. Our anywhere and anytime capacity to grasp the personality and divinity factors of our highest concept of deity.
Okay. That's just one little paragraph there. What's the key there? Okay, we crave the concept of the infinite, self-existent deity. I am, you know, and your relationship to that self-existent deity. You know, if only I could just, you know, be so one with that self-existent fact. You know, your spiritual consciousness feels that craving, that, you know that's there. Many religionists of the past have so fixated on that, the whole God part kind of got lost in the process. You know, we all know about, you know, Hinduism and Brahmanism and whatnot, okay? I mean, Buddhism. But we worship the experience idea of God. Okay, now here is that another spot where they're trying to remind you, when you use the term God, what does God mean literally, that word? Well, it's personalized deity, but that's revealed in the book. What does the word God, as an English word, no good comes from God. What does the word God mean?
Initiator.
Okay. Poke, 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 poke. Initiator. It's not just an idea, it's an experience idea. You experience, I'm being initiated. I'm not alone. Something transcendent loves me and is trying to get me, you know, to wake up. How cool is that? I think I should acknowledge that. You know, but we worship the experience idea of God. You're not going to worship a God that's the watchmaker, winds it all up and just, you know, there's no experience with that. He's just somewhere, if anywhere, and then you're just part of a big machine. You're a cog in a machine. Where does worship come out of that? Worship comes from you experience that laser beam of the Father injected into the whole that engages you. You respond to that in worship. Okay? That whole prayer in worship, you know, it's so cool. You'll turn your back on self, at least for a moment, and put your voice to the cosmos in worship. You know? Okay.
Is that like the knocking on the door?
Yeah. He knocks, right? The Father knocks. What did Jesus reveal about the Father? He knocks. Yeah. All you have to do is open. All you have to do is complete the circuit. But you can't do that with wishful thinking. You've got to supply the favorable conditions, you know. Lions can't complete the circuit. If you're just a fancy animal, you can't complete that circuit. You've got to get yourself up there to true human status so that you can be part of the Father's circuit. You can open the door. The door is not on the first level of meaning. It's not on the second level of meaning. Okay. It's the hatch at the top of the sixth level of meaning. You've got to get all the way up there. Okay? It's like the old notion of the celestial sphere, you know, the dome, you know, the flat earth and the dome of the sky, you know, and you float up, you know, and then you go through the hatch door, you know, to get to heaven on the other side of the dome, you know, where there's those little holes where the radiance of heaven shines through, and they're called stars, you know. I mean, okay, there is a hatch door like that. But it's in the mind. It's not in the physical world. There is a hatch door like that. It's at the top of the sixth level of meaning. Get up there and open up the door. Yeah. Let the cosmos in. All right. When you recognize it, anywhere, anytime, you can hear the knock. poke. Poke, 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 poke. Okay? Yeah? That's just, look, how cool is that? Okay, that's what they're trying to, I mean, it sounds simple, but just, you know, let it sink in. I mean, don't take that for granted. That's just way cool. No matter where you are or when you are, poke, 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 poke. I'm here. Just tapping on the window. You know, it's a glass door. He's tapping on the window. Yeah, can't you see him up there? You know, get up there and get a hold of the knob. All right.
The consciousness of a victorious human life on Earth is born of that creature faith which dares to challenge each recurring episode of existence when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it, a part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And that is the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith.
Okay. The poetry there is obvious. Look at the details, though, too. You know, we've built up to that final paragraph. They use that Father Absolute, that technical term again. Just one little bit here, and then we'll, you know, we'll call it a quits for the night. But just notice that Father Absolute, okay? When I look back to the point where I have the Father Absolute, I've got the reservoir of will. If I'm invoking that, I'm reminding, they're trying to remind you, where did your personality come from? Where's the reservoir? You know, the infinite one reservoir, that will, right there with the Father Absolute. Okay, and that is the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith. You know, when you're first reading that, you're thinking, oh, they must be talking about the adjuster. And it's like, no, no, they're not talking about the adjuster. They're talking about my personality. Okay? That's what they're talking about there. So, who is this one? Okay? This whole bit of, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it. Okay, well, if it's not the adjuster, am I schizophrenic? Or what are they talking about here? Okay? You have a self. Even if I, as a mere self, cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it. There's a part of that self that's personal. You know, we know we're not wholehearted personal selves yet. We've got a lot of animal origin being baggage. A lot of it is just self. You know, it's not worthy of being called personal self yet. Okay? But there is some little measure of a personal self, okay? That's the one that lives in me, who can and will do it. The personal self has choice, has purposing of spirit potential. That one that can purpose spirit, can choose, it can purpose spirit, and that spirit dominates mind, and that mind dominates matter. That mindful self needs something transcendent. It needs a transcendent parent to help it. You know, when we do this, you know, we just invoked it a second ago. You know, here's the animal origin adjutant self over here, and there's the cosmos over here. You know, prayer is this wing, and worship is that wing. And, you know, we always have this center point, you know, in this image. You know, this is a temple here. Who lives in the temple? The personal self. This is the personal self that's looking to just the, you know, energy self over here, the adjutant mind self, and the cosmos over there. Okay? Or invoke it in the hourglass. Okay? For, you know, levels of meaning. Here's the third level of meaning at the neck of the hourglass, and then the upper levels of meaning, you know, there are three that are built by the creative mother spirit, the three cosmic intuitions, actually create that capacity, that volume up there, that upper domain. Okay, the mere animal self lives down here. The personal self lives up here. Okay, so look at that. Even if I cannot do this, that's the voice down here in the bottom of the hourglass. Okay, there lives in me, the whole me, okay, one who can and will do it. The one that's up here, the personal self, who's above that. You know? Clear the throat of your personal self. Give it voice. It's the parent. This is the child. Speak. You know? Take delight in cultivating a personal self that can do this. You know, you're in a difficult situation. Effort, struggle have led you to conflict, have led your self to conflict. You need the personal self to step in and lift you up so that you can overcome that conflict. You can't go around conflict. Conflicts can only have to be overcome. So something above the self that's bonking its head on this wall has to reach down and lift it up. You know, that effort circle kind of with faith, you know, the exercise of your personal self reaches down, grabs a hold of that self, lifts it up, gives that self a whole new determination. You know, I could go forward now, and I'm going to go forward. You know, I'm going to love like I couldn't love before because I'm bigger now. I'm going to demonstrate loyalty like I've never done before because I'm bigger now. I'm closer to the supreme loyalty that I'm trying to identify with. I've made progress. Yeah. Yeah, that's what they're invoking in that last sentence. Take a hold of the father part. Don't call the mother part the father part. Okay? See, I think this is the irony. See how many ironies there are when you start to sort this out. There's a false exaltation of the animal origin, mother, you know, thing that the mother is upholding very patiently, you know, waiting for it to reach up and grab a hold of actual relationship to the father instead of being self-satisfied and calling, you know, its animal nature in relationship to the father. It's not automatically in relationship to the father. It has to choose. Okay? It has to choose to go up. Okay? So that's, you can see this section, okay, we only got through one section. There's a lot in this section. There's 2 hours on this section. The last section is much more straightforward. Everyone is familiar with the book, knows where that goes. So we'll pick that up next time. But this is one of those sections where this is very fifth epical kind of a section. In order to really talk about what's in here, we had to use some of our stuff. Okay? You know, we just couldn't use what we learned, you know, in church and, you know, in Sunday school or whatever.
Chris, really quick.
Yeah. Yep.
Even now, has your faith saved you?
You're only actually saved by faith. You know, you're not automatically connected to eternity. You have to choose. All right. So anyway, I hope that wasn't too laborious. I actually didn't think it was going to go that long. I thought we might actually do the last section too. But it's just a really important, it's important to spend some time on the parts of the book that are really challenging you beyond the fourth epical revelation, very directly. Reflect on that. How much of the book do I go through and I go, oh, I like that section because it's a lot like what I know from the fourth epical revelation. This section, I don't know, I kind of just skip through that a little bit. See, most likely that one that you're not sort of feeling something initially, it's because it's a real fifth epical kind of section. It's got stuff in it that seems to be distracting to your spiritual consciousness.
That's why we're here.
You know, and that's the point. You know, it's trying to get you to stop ignoring your material consciousness, to combine it with your spiritual consciousness and get some cosmic consciousness going. You just start challenging yourself to not be so quick to try to go around a section, you know, that doesn't seem to be initially ringing your spiritual bells. If you can go up with it, you'll find a tone in that bell that you never knew before. You know, you'll find a ringing of your spiritual consciousness that you were incapable of before, because you'll be bigger. And there's so many resonances that are only there when the resonating cavity is larger. Harmonies that can't fit in a small cavity can fit in that bigger cavity. All right, let's take a little moment here.